Grit is living life like it's a marathon, not a sprint. Angela Duckworth.
Man's time here is finite, but the influence of a man is infinite. The question is, what shall we do with the daylight that remains?
All right, children, here we go again. Welcome back. Today we're talking about the book Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance, written by Angela Duckworth. This one is a keeper, especially coming off the back of last week. I was really thrilled to be reading this book. I love the cover of it. I love the idea of it. It's well written, and this one is really up my alley. It's basically a lot of scientific studies and then storytelling in that. And so she did a great job with this. This is Angela Duckworth, PhD, is a 2013 MacArthur Fellow and Professor of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. She has advised the World Bank, NBA, NFL teams, and Fortune 500 CEOs. She is also the founder and CEO of Character Lab, a nonprofit whose mission is to advise scientific insights that help children thrive. She completed her BA in neurology at Harvard, her MSc in neuroscience at Oxford, and her PhD in psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance is her first book and an instant New York Times bestseller. And I can see why after reading it. As I said, this is a gem. So let's get into this. I'm going to front load it a bit because that's where she sort of gives herself credibility and some of the definitions of what grit is and how to identify grit and where it comes from. And then as she moves throughout the book, it moves more to kind of left and right of grit, like what is passion and how's that associated with grit, or finding purpose in your work, or what is perseverance and how does that kind of attribute to grit? How do you parent for grit? Things like that. So I had far too many bookmarks in here to do it all. So I'm going to have to pick and choose some of this, but I don't want to steal her work and make it a poor man's audiobook. Anyway, my intent here is to give you a few golden nuggets of wisdom, give you the flavor of this book, and then hopefully if that's for you, you'll go out and purchase your own copy. So let's jump in here. So right off the bat, chapter one, she's talking about getting into the military academy at West Point. She says, each year in their junior year of high school, more than 14,000 applicants begin the admissions process. This pool is winnowed to just 4,000 who succeed in getting their required nomination. Slightly more than half of those applicants, about 2,500, meet West Point's rigorous academic and physical standards. And from the select group, just 1,200 are admitted and enrolled. Nearly all the men and women who come to West Point were varsity athletes. Most were team captains. And yet one in five cadets will drop out before graduation. What's more remarkable is that historically, a substantial fraction of dropouts leave in their first summer during an intensive seven-week training program named, even in official literature, Beast Barracks, or for short, just Beast. So who makes it through Beast? And this is where she starts diving into the literature. She and many other people have tried to work on this equation, like how could we rate kids before they get to the academy to understand who's most likely to succeed and actually see it through. And it turns out it's not whether or not you were the captain or super popular or very intellectually smart. It, as you might guess from the cover of this book, it's really their grit score. The whole candidate score is the single most important factor in West Point's admissions, and yet it didn't reliably predict who would make it through Beast. In fact, cadets with the highest whole candidate scores were just as likely to drop out as those with the lowest, and this was why Mike's door was open to me. So Mike, also working on this problem, working on admissions, finding out who would make it and who wouldn't. They start to discover some very interesting things. So Angela starts digging into data, doing interviews. She's interviewing those that she calls grit paragons, people who are highly successful and seem to exhibit a very gritty personality and stick-to-itiveness. And she starts pulling out little nuggets, and you'll hear that throughout the book. So jumping into sort of that scene, she says, apparently it was critically important and not at all easy to keep going after failure. Some people are great when things are going well, but they fall apart when things aren't. High achievers described in these interviews really stuck it out. In quotes, this one guy, he wasn't actually the best writer at the beginning. I mean, we used to read his stories and have a laugh because the writing was so, you know, clumsy and melodramatic. But he got better and better. And last year, he won a Guggenheim, end quotes. And they were constantly driven to improve, saying things like, she's never satisfied. You'd think she would be by now, but she's her own harshest critic. The highly accomplished were paragons of perseverance. Why were the highly accomplished so dogged in their pursuit? For most, there was no realistic expectation of ever catching up to their ambitions. In their own eyes, they were never good enough. They were the opposite of complacent, and yet in a very real sense, they were satisfied being unsatisfied. Each was chasing something of unparalleled interest and importance, and it was the chase as much as the capture that was gratifying. Even if some of the things they had to do were boring or frustrating or even painful, they wouldn't dream of giving up. Their passion was enduring. In sum, no matter the domain, the highly successful had a kind of ferocious determination that played out in two ways. First, these exemplars were unusually resilient and hardworking. Second, they knew in a very, very deep way what it was they wanted. They not only had determination, they had direction. It was the combination of passion and perseverance that made high achievers special. In a word, they had grit. She goes on to talk about a grit scale that she developed, trying to understand who had grit and who didn't. And that grit scale is in here. You can actually take a test and it'll help you understand just how gritty you are. So back to the book, by the last day of Beast, 71 cadets had dropped out. Grit turned out to be an astounding, reliable predictor of who made it through and who did not. The next year, I returned to West Point to run the same study. This time, 62 cadets dropped out of Beast, and again, grit predicted who would stay. In contrast, stayers and leavers had indistinguishable whole candidate scores. I looked a little closer at the individual components that make up the score. Again, no differences. So what matters for making it through Beast? Not your SAT scores, not your high school rank, not your leadership experience, not your athletic ability, not your whole cadet score. What matters is grit. Chapter 2 is called Distracted by Talent. I thought that was really interesting. Basically, that people give credits to people who appear to be gifted, talented. We might take two people. One seems to really just work for everything they've got, and the other one seems to have a natural ability, and we'll give the one who has natural ability more advantage. We're willing to pay more for an employee that seems really naturally skilled. But in the studies that they do, the hard workers tend to achieve more and in the end do better work. They are driven to continually improve, to produce, and they actually are a more valuable person to an organization or just to the industry they're in because of their grit and stick-to-itiveness, their willingness to look for feedback and implement feedback and improvement. Whereas the one that has gifts, they might not be driven to improve. They just had some sort of talent. So kind of an interesting chapter there. In the following chapter, she says, a few years ago, I read a study of competitive swimmers titled The Mundanity of Excellence. The title of the article encapsulates its major conclusion. The most dazzling human achievements are, in fact, the aggregate of countless individual elements, each of which is, in a sense, ordinary. So she goes into the work that Dan Chambliss has done, a sociologist, and he looks at the details of things like swimmers, for example, and that excellence is actually within reach for most people. Now, you might not be able to achieve that excellence of Michael Phelps or LeBron James simply because of your physique, right? Phelps had all these anatomical advantages, as does LeBron James for basketball. And so, you know, me being 6'2" and not all that big of a guy, I was a little bit disadvantaged to LeBron, but achieving some level of excellence is very attainable for most people. And he's basically saying that if you can improve all these, maybe even thousands of different skills and continually work on those and make them subconscious and habit and perfect each one, all of which are doable, you could reach a level of excellence in something like swimming, right? Very near the top, very close to those spectacular performers that we all are in awe of, are a whole bunch of people that were very ordinary people that worked for excellence. So skipping ahead, she just finished a speech at a graduation, and a young entrepreneur rushes up and he has some questions and they're talking. And so this is in quotes her discussion here, and she says, "And here's the really important thing. Grit is about working on something you care about so much that you're willing to stay loyal to it." He says, it's doing what you love. I get that. She says, right. It's doing what you love, but not just falling in love, staying in love. So the perseverance factor. So not just really enjoying something, but being super dedicated to it day in and day out for a very, very long time is how you see grit, right? That's where grit shows up. And all that effort accumulates to something really great. Now, the grit score, this is interesting. She has basically 10 questions, and you rate yourself, not at all like me, not much like me, somewhat like me, mostly like me, and very much like me. And you take these 10 questions, add those up, and essentially you get a score. And so she's on the next page, got it broken down, the percentile that you would be. So if you were a 2.5 grit score, you're in the bottom 10%, right, of gritty people. 50% is a 3.8 grit score, and then 4.9 is in the, you know, top 1% of gritty people. So you can take that grit score and understand kind of where you fall within that. But the good news is, if you're not very gritty, grit can be learned. You can learn grit. So she goes on to describe some of that in the book. Now, these gritty people that stick to something very long, they don't like every aspect of the thing they do, whether it's a sport or a job or building a business. They like the general idea of it, the long-term future, the purpose or service they provide to the world around them. But within that are a bunch of other things that they actually don't like or find boring or mundane or even painful, but they're willing to put up with those and go through that in order to continue to play the game. And so when you look at that in a goals perspective, so she has a diagram of goals here, and there's like the top level, which is your ultimate large scale goal. It may be more abstract, and down under that are a bunch of levels of more immediate goals, daily tasks, things you have to do. Some of them may be undesirable and mundane, but you're willing to do them to achieve your ultimate goal, right? And she starts explaining that a bit. She says, in the diagram I've sketched here, there are just three levels. That's an oversimplification. Between the lowest and the highest level might be several layers of mid-level goals. For instance, getting out the door by 8 a.m. is a low-level goal. It only matters because of a mid-level goal, arriving at work on time. Why do you care about that? Because you want to be punctual. Why do you care about that? Because being punctual shows respect for people with whom you work. Why is that important? Because you strive to be a good leader. If in the course of asking yourself these why questions, your answer is simply just because, then you know you've gotten to the top of a global hierarchy. The top level goal is not a means to any other end. It is instead an end in itself. Some psychologists like to call this an ultimate concern. Myself, I think of this top level goal as a compass that gives direction and meaning to all the goals below it. Some of that right there captures the essence of my ebook Ingrained, basically saying like you need to have a direction. You got to set your compass on something. But really the best way to set goals is what's the lifestyle that you're actually willing to do on a daily basis that marches you towards that goal. That's how you should be setting your New Year's goals, right? Saying, okay, I want to implement this into my daily lifestyle. And as you start doing that, you'll notice nuance, problems, things that didn't work out, or things that you overthought. A lot of times the problem that people make when setting New Year's resolutions is they get in that goal mode and they have a lot of passion towards this change. But then days or weeks in, that passion is really dull. It's not a very hot fire. And the amount of energy that they're actually willing to put into that goal is way less than what they thought they would, right? So you need to find a way to figure out that balance. Like, what's the real amount of effort I'm willing to put in on good days and bad days to this goal and lifestyle change? And that's how you change your life. Back to the book. Grit is about holding the same top-level goal for a very long time. Furthermore, this life philosophy, as Pete Carroll might put it, is so interesting and important that it organizes a great deal of your waking activity. In very gritty people, most mid-level and low-level goals are in some way or another related to that ultimate goal. In contrast, a lack of grit can come from having less coherent goal structures. Here are a few ways a lack of grit can show itself. I've met many young people who can articulate a dream, for example, to be a doctor or to play basketball in the NBA, and can vividly imagine how wonderful that would be. But they can't point to the mid-level and lower-level goals that will get them there. Their goal hierarchy has a top-level goal, but no supporting mid-level or low-level goals. This is what my good friend and fellow psychologist Gabrielle Odigen calls positive fantasizing. Gabrielle's research suggests that indulging in visions of a positive future without figuring out how to get there, chiefly by considering what obstacles stand in the way, has short-term payoffs but long-term costs. In short term, you feel pretty great about your aspiration to be a doctor. In the long term, you live with the disappointment of not having achieved your goal. Even more common, I think, is having a bunch of mid-level goals that don't correspond to any unified top-level goal, or having a few competing goal hierarchies that aren't in any way connected with each other. To some extent, goal conflict is a necessary feature of human existence. For instance, I have one goal hierarchy as a professional and another as a mother. So I definitely have experienced those things going through life. As I get a little older and have experienced more things, I feel like I'm narrowing my focus on a few things and getting more consistent about participating in those, working on those versus competing goal hierarchies, right? I might have had, when I was young, maybe in high school or college, I had aspirations for sports, I had aspirations for music, I had aspirations in finance, and these things don't necessarily work together, right? They don't share mid-level goals, and therefore they distract from one another. And if you have goals that distract from each other, you never become super proficient and effective in one. But being human, that exists to some extent, as she said, right? A professional and a parent. Those are two completely separate hierarchies, and it's a difficult thing to balance, but you know, it can be done. It's just if we have too many of them, then it really gets chaotic. Here's some suggestions from Warren Buffett. I like this. She says, Warren Buffett, the self-made multi-billionaire whose personal wealth, acquired entirely within his own lifetime, is roughly twice the size of Harvard University's endowment. Reportedly gave his pilot a simple three-step process for prioritizing. The story goes like this. Buffett turns to his faithful pilot and says that he must have dreams greater than flying Buffett around to where he needs to go. The pilot confesses that yes, he does. And then Buffett takes him through three steps. First, you write down a list of 25 career goals. Second, you do some soul searching and circle the five highest priority goals, just five. Third, you take a good hard look at the 20 goals you didn't circle. These you avoid at all cost. They're what distract you. They eat away time and energy, taking your eye from the goals that matter more. That's tough, right? Basically, cutting off part of your character and personality, some of your interests, saying, look, I had goals in these areas, but I'm just going to say it now. I'm not going to chase these or think about these or spend time on these. I'm going to chase these five. I think it's wise. There's some interesting studies in here referenced in chapter four about intelligence or IQ and perseverance. And I mean, you may guess that, again, the person with more perseverance tends to achieve more than somebody who's got a high IQ but not much perseverance. Grit Grows, chapter five. Here's another striking example and one more relevant to the science of success, the Flynn effect, named after Jim Flynn, the New Zealand social scientist who discovered it. The Flynn effect refers to startling gains in IQ scores over the past century. How big are the gains? On the most widely used IQ test today, gains have averaged more than 15 points in the last 50 years in more than 30 countries that have been studied. Put another way, if you scored people a century ago against modern norms, they would have an IQ score of 70, borderline for having an intellectual disability. If you scored people today against the norms of a century ago, we would have an average IQ score of 130, the typical cut score for mentally gifted programs. So when she first learned of this, she went out to see Flynn and understand what was happening. I thought this was pretty interesting as far as improvement. As a species, we're getting better and better at abstract reasoning. By way of explaining mass gains in certain IQ subsets, but not in others, Flynn told a story about basketball and television. Basketball at all levels of competition has gotten more competitive over the last century. Flynn played a little ball himself as a student and remembers the game changing even within a few years. What happened? According to Flynn, what happened was television. Basketball was a great game to watch on the small screen, and the exposure fueled the game's popularity. Once television became a household fixture, more kids started playing the game, trying left-hand layups, crossover dribbles, graceful hook shots, and other skills that seemed routine amongst star players. And by getting better, each kid inadvertently enriched the learning environment for the kids he or she was playing against, because one thing that makes you better at basketball is playing with kids who are just a little more skilled. Flynn called this virtuous cycle of skill improvement the social multiplier effect, and he used the same logic to explain generational changes in abstract reasoning. More and more over the past century, our jobs and daily lives ask us to think analytically, logically. We go to school for longer, and in school, we're asked more and more to reason rather than rely on rote memorization. Either small environmental differences or genetic ones can trigger a virtuous cycle. Either way, the effects are multiplied socially through culture because each of us enriches the environments of all of us. So that in itself is quite interesting, but on the following page, it says, one explanation for this data is that there's a sort of reverse Flynn effect for grit. For instance, it's possible that adults in their seventh decade of life are grittier because they grew up in a very different cultural era. Perhaps one whose values and norms emphasize sustained passion and perseverance more than has been the case recently. In other words, it could be that the greatest generation is grittier than the millennials because cultural forces are different today than yesterday. Basically, our lives have become super easy to bounce to and fro. It's not hard to make money, at least decent livable wages. You can do that in physical manual labor. You can do it on computers. You can do it by entertaining people. You can do it by podcasting. You can do it by gaming. Like, it's just, it's crazy. You can make money in a million ways, and jumping from one thing to the next is not difficult. We have floors as far as government funding and unemployment and insurance and all that stuff. We have ways that, you know, we don't let people fall too far. So it's not even scary to jump ship and try something else. We don't necessarily have a culture that encourages a lot of grit. So referring to those interviews with these grit paragons again, she says, these stories of grit are one kind of data, and they complement the more systematic quantitative studies I've done in places like West Point and the National Spelling Bee. Together, the research reveals the psychological assets that mature paragons of grit have in common. There are four. They counter each of the buzz killers listed above, and they tend to develop over the years in a particular order. First comes interest. Next comes the capacity to practice. Third is purpose. And finally, hope. She dives more into these things. Skipping to the area of interest and following your passion, she says, if you'd like to follow your passion but haven't yet fostered one, you must begin at the beginning, discovery. Ask yourself a few simple questions. What do I like to think about? Where does my mind wander? What do I really care about? What matters most to me? How do I enjoy spending my time? And in contrast, what do I find absolutely unbearable? If you find it hard to answer these questions, try recalling your teen years, the stage of life at which vocational interests commonly sprout. Practice. In one of my earliest research studies, I found that grittier kids at the National Spelling Bee practiced more than their less gritty competitors. These extra hours of practice, in turn, explained their superior performance in final competition. She goes into quite deep detail on these children in the Spelling Bee and how some of them spent hours and hours daily working on spelling. Quite impressive. And that the grittier kids who could put more time in, they won. They performed better. Kaizen is Japanese for resisting the plateau of arrested development. Its literal translation is continuous improvement. I also found this section of the book very interesting, talking about deliberate practice, how the best people in the world in their industry practice. And how do they do it? Through deliberate practice. They'll perform something, get immediate feedback, think on it, make adjustments, and go to work on that weak spot. And so these people who excel practice differently. Some ice skaters show up to the ice and spend a couple hours, and some ice skaters show up to the ice knowing exactly what they're working on, which is one of their weaknesses. And then they'll continue to get coaching and feedback and try and find a way to improve that weakness. And then once they've solidified that, it's like on to the next weakness. Where's another one? So they have this ability to take negative, or I guess constructive, criticism and then spend hours deliberately working on that thing. You know, a lot of people, maybe even most, would rather just hear the positive and carry on about life with this happy-go-lucky attitude, like all is well. But those people are not very competitive with these grit paragons. She also describes how these high performers set goals. So they also set stretch goals, something that's beyond their current performance. Then with undivided attention and great effort, experts strive to reach their stretch goal. Interestingly, many choose to do so while nobody's watching, trying to improve on their own. You know, I have this book behind my head here with Kobe Bryant, the Mamba mentality. He's notorious for being at the gym when everybody else was either partying or still sleeping in the morning, right? Both. He would do a workout in the super early part of the morning, be home before his girls even woke up, have breakfast, take them to school, go back, work out again, come back and take a nap, rest, do whatever he needed to, be with his wife. Go work out again, be home to get his girls from school and see them. They would go to bed. He'd go work out again, right? He just spent so much time in the gym. He had this philosophy that if he was putting in hours and hours more per day, then somebody that was even very, very dedicated to the game could not possibly catch up with him because of the sheer number of hours they would have to put in to get to that point. He put such a gap between himself and the rest of the field through deliberate practice that it would be impossible for others to catch up and pass him until his career was done. Now, I've been harping on this lately, and so it was fun to hear her sort of reinforce it with her data and the things she's learned from these grit paragons. For getting the most out of deliberate practice, make it a habit. By this, I mean, figure out when and where you're most comfortable doing deliberate practice. Once you've made your selection, do deliberate practice then and there every day. Why? Because routines are a godsend when it comes to doing something hard. A mountain of research studies, including a few of my own, show that when you have a habit of practicing at the same time and in the same place every day, you hardly have to think about getting started. You just do. Skipping to chapter 9, which is titled Hope. Basically, people who have an optimistic mindset think that they have some sort of power to change their circumstances, perform better in everything in life. They do better. And here's an interesting but somewhat sad science experiment that I'll read to you. She says, "Little did I know when I was floundering in my neurobiology class that I was recreating the conditions of a famous psychological experiment. Let me wind back the clock to 1964. Two first-year psychology doctoral students named Marty Seligman and Steve Mayer are in a windowless laboratory watching a caged dog receive electric shocks to its back paws. The shocks come randomly and without warning. If the dog does nothing, the shock lasts 5 seconds. but if the dog pushes its nose against a panel at the front of the cage, the shock ends early. In a separate cage, another dog is receiving the same shocks at exactly the same intervals, but there's no panel to push on. In other words, both dogs get the exact same dosage of shock at the exact same times, but only the first dog is in control of how long each shock lasts. After 64 shocks, both dogs go back to their home cages and new dogs are brought in for the same procedure. The next day, one by one, all the dogs are placed in a different cage called a shuttle box. In the middle, there's a low wall just high enough that the dogs can leap the barrier if they try. A high-pitched tone plays, heralding an impending shock, which comes through the floor of the half of the shuttle box where the dog is standing. Nearly all the dogs who had control over the shocks the previous day learn to leap the barrier. They hear the tone and jump over the wall to safety. In contrast, two-thirds of the dogs who had no control over the shocks the previous day just lie down whimpering, passively waiting for the punishments to stop. The seminal experiment proved for the first time that it isn't suffering that leads to hopelessness. It's suffering you think you can't control. So there's this thing called learned optimism or learned pessimism. Pessimists tend to have this attitude of victimhood. I'm a victim to this and there's nothing I can do. Helplessness. Whereas optimists maintain some sense of hope and optimism that they can do something to change the factors that are currently creating their state of being. And optimists sell more insurance, they perform better in school, they achieve more awards, they do all kinds of things. They're happier in their marriages. The list is on and on. So having some sense of hope that you can actually improve and continue to grow and change your circumstances is a major factor in being very gritty and persevering. They basically recreated this study years later on rats this time, but this time they used rats who would be teenagers at a developmental time in their brain. And similar thing, they could spin the wheel and the shocks would stop, and then the other group, there was nothing they could do about it. Then they brought these rats back when they would be adults, so several weeks later, as rats' lifespan is quite short. And here's what they learned. Adolescent rats who experienced stress they could not control grew up to be adult rats who, after being subjected to uncontrollable shocks a second time, behaved timidly. This was not unusual. They learned to be helpless in the same way that any other rat would. In contrast, adolescent rats who experienced stress they could control grew up to be more adventurous and, most astoundingly, appeared to be inoculated against learned helplessness in adulthood. That's right. When these resilient rats grew up, the usual uncontrollable shock procedures no longer made them helpless. In other words, what didn't kill the young rats when by their own efforts they could control what was happening made them stronger for life. So interestingly, as children, we need challenges in our life. We need pressure, but we need to have some sort of control and the ability to succeed. So she goes on to talk with Steve about this experiment and other findings he understands. Steve says, "The long-term story needs some more explanation," he continued. "We think there is a plasticity in that circuitry. If you experience adversity, something pretty potent that you overcome on your own during your youth, you develop a different way of dealing with adversity later on. It's important that the adversity be pretty potent because these brain areas really have to wire together in some fusion. And that doesn't happen with just minor inconveniences. So you can't just talk someone into believing they can master challenges. That's right. Just telling somebody they can overcome adversity isn't enough. For the rewiring to happen, you have to activate the control circuitry at the same time as those low-level areas. That happens when you experience mastery at the same time as adversity." So, of course, that made me wonder as a parent, like, how do I get this in my children, right? How do I offer this adversity without putting them in, you know, harmful situations or negative situations? But luckily for all of us, chapter 10 is Parenting for Grit. And while she says there are no great experiments or data specifically correlating how to parent for grit, there's a lot of information on grit and there's a lot of information on parenting, but nothing on the two. But she says she gives us her best kind of hunch or guess at what can be done. She gives some very interesting stories on two people. One is Steve Young, the famous football player whose parents were quite rigid. They were really kind of nose to the grindstone. We never give up kind of people, and taught Steve to be very gritty and persevere kind of no matter what. And then she brings up this other family who allowed both their son and daughter to drop out of school early. Their daughter dropped out at like 16, but it was with a purpose. They were going to sort of be apprenticed by these people and pursue their passion for the arts. And she also became extremely successful and demonstrates grit. And so she basically says that parents can be both authoritarian and very loving, and they can be very loving and open, but authoritarian, or show the boundaries, right? And say, look, these are the rules. If you commit yourself to something, you're going to give it all you got and you're going to see it through. And there are certain times when you can withdraw from various things. There are moral boundaries we don't cross. There's right. And so they had structure in their lives, and those parents instilled that in there. She says that the playing fields for grit are extracurricular activities for children. She says these activities possess two important features that are hard to replicate in any other setting. First, there's an adult in charge, ideally a supportive and demanding one, who is not the parent. Second, these pursuits are designed to cultivate interest, practice, purpose, and hope. The ballet studio, the recital hall, the dojo, the basketball court, the gridiron, these are the playing fields of grit. As a parent and social scientist, I would recommend that as soon as your child is old enough, you find something they might enjoy doing outside of class and sign them up. In fact, if I could wave a magic wand, I'd have all the children in the world engage in at least one extracurricular activity of their choice. And as for those in high school, I'd require that they stick with at least one activity for more than a year. For starters, a few researchers have equipped kids with beepers so that throughout the day, they can be prompted to report on what they're doing and how they feel at that very moment. When kids are in class, they report feeling challenged, but especially unmotivated. Hanging out with friends, in contrast, is not very challenging, but super fun. And what about extracurricular activities? When kids are playing sports or music or rehearsing for the school play, they're both challenged and having fun. There's no other experience in the lives of young people that reliably provides this combination of challenge and intrinsic motivation. There are countless research studies showing that kids who are more involved in extracurriculars fare better on just about every conceivable metric. They earn better grades, have higher self-esteem, are less likely to get in trouble, and so forth. A handful of these studies are longitudinal, meaning that researchers waited to see what happened to kids later in life. These longer-term studies come to the same conclusion. More participation in activities predicts better outcomes. So the last thing I'll share with you in this book is the predictive power of follow-through was striking. After controlling for high school grades and SAT scores, follow-through in high school extracurriculars predicted graduating from college with academic honors better than any variable. Likewise, follow-through was the single best predictor of holding an appointed or elected leadership position in young adulthood. And finally, better than any of the more than 100 personal characteristics Willingham had measured, follow-through predicted notable accomplishments for a young adult in all domains, from the arts and writing to entrepreneurship and community service. Notably, the particular pursuits to which students had devoted themselves in high school didn't matter, whether it was tennis, student government, or debate team. The key was that students had signed up for something, signed up again the following year, and during that time had made some kind of progress. So I will leave you with that one. This is the book Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. This is one that's going to stay with me. Maybe I'll have to put it up here on my shelf behind me as kind of one of the premier books to read. It sounds like grit is the thing you want to develop, whether you're smart or not so smart, whether you're skilled or not so skilled. Grit can compensate for any deficits, because persevering, sticking to something, getting feedback, working on your weaknesses, and doing it over and over and over for a very long time turns into excellence. So, Angela, you wrote a fabulous book. I really like this one. This is Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance by Angela Duckworth. As always, the link to this book will be in the show notes. So if you want to go purchase your copy, the link is provided. And I appreciate you guys showing up. We'll catch you on the next one. Hey, thanks for listening to the entire episode. As a token of gratitude, I want to give you a discount on my book, Ingrained. Head over to bronsonwilks.com/store and download Ingrained for less than $1 with the coupon code GOALS, G-O-A-L-S.